Welcome back to Pax Europiana, the podcast about peace in Europe. And this one is now the 14th of November. And this is a very important day where Yugoslavia started to be an American-funded client state. That happened in the year 1951. The U.S. Congress, on the request of President Truman, has asked for financial assistance by the U.S. Congress for Yugoslavia. That is kind of less well known, unfortunately, today, because from this moment on, Yugoslavia was, of course, still bloc-free and later then part of the non-aligned movement. But the financial and market access, the financial support and the market access was to the West very much. And the money came from the U.S. taxpayers. This happened as a response to the split between Tito and Stalin. Stalin still very much alive at this moment. Obviously, the Korea War, this huge and really atrocious conflict between the superpowers, between the United Nations and the U.S. It was a United Nations-led war, and North Korea, China, and the Soviet Union on the other side. And obviously, it was important to have allies, and that's why the Yugoslavian state has looked for support, and they have found it in their former, in a way, very much the enemy. Because one reason why Yugoslavia has split from the Soviet Union in 1948, it was not only personalities, but it was very much about the Greek Civil War. The Americans were supporting the Greeks and winning the Greek Civil War was for the Greek conservatives or nationalists against the communists of the North, especially. As funded very much by Yugoslavia, and in as politics from time to time is quite confusing, Stalin actually tried to hold Tito back, dominate the socialist camp, and Yugoslavia was obviously then seen as a very much an opponent in the communist camp, was on the 28th of June excluded, and as a rather poor and war-torn country as it was at that time, it didn't have any external funding sources anymore, not from the Soviet Union, not from the West. So that was a very lonely position. And so Yugoslavia was ready to be funded in an extra budget line, which was decided on the 14th November 1951. It was very controversial because it was the only socialist dictatorship which was supported by the U.S. in that context. But also when you look at the World War II, contrary to common belief, it was absolutely the British who made sure that Tito's partisans win the confrontation in Yugoslavia with Nazi Germany, but also inside the various groups of resistance fighters, because there were several groups, and obviously the one with the best Western backing, and that was Tito and his partisans, they have won. So it's not completely out of context, this shift towards the West, which basically was already a reality since, I would say, 42, 43, and then the massive support of the British via Egypt for the partisans, leading then to the victory. And then from 44, it was again very close coordination with Stalin, but that lasted only 2 years because too many alpha animals were not possible in the Soviet camp. And so on the 14th November 1951, it was official. This was official U.S. Congress deciding for supporting Yugoslavia, and Yugoslavia stayed actually in this kind of semi-relation with the West, always a very complicated partner in various stages, but more or less until the 24th of April 1987, when basically in this situation in Kosovo, Milosevic started his grip or coup to take over power in the name of Serb nationalism. and he has basically from that moment on in 87 until he then took fully power and also then removed Stambolic. Stambolic was still in many ways in the tradition of Tito's Yugoslavia, they were not pro-Western, that's too much to be said. It was a very confused position, but it was a kind of socialist neutrality, a third way. Economically, obviously, it was a disaster all the time, but it was somehow possible to keep it up until 87. But then I think also the insiders in Belgrade, they knew already that the whole system cannot sustain itself because there was such a debt load and there was no money anymore to be had. Why? Because there were no reforms. It was obviously a socialist country. And also this kind of Cold War was coming to an end. Yugoslavia very much exploded, not only because of the internal centrifugal powers, but because the Cold War, once Gorbachev came to power, and he had no money, he had certainly no money to spare for the Yugoslavia, and also then the efforts or the interest of America and the West to fund ever more debts and to finance a already totally broke Yugoslavia, that was coming to an end as well. Because the strategic interest, it was not love which was making Truman and the American taxpayers to support Yugoslavia from 51 to basically it came to an end also with the first major warning that was in 84. Just let me take a look that it was in 84. That was the warning. It is called the the directive number, 133 on the 14th of March, 84, the US Security Council has issued a staunch warning that such kind of debt level of 20 billion external debt is not sustainable. And also the whole interest in funding Yugoslavia was no longer so big because the Cold War was already no longer so hot as it was in the 70s and in the 50s, in the 60s, for 30 years it was raging, 35 years. But in 84 already there was the point where basically it was no longer so interesting for the Americans to fund whatever it costed to keep Yugoslavia out of the Soviet camp. And the Russians also had no money, so the whole business case of Yugoslavian unity somehow blackmailing the West or the East into paying and buying the substandard products was falling apart. And I would like to explain as well that Yugoslavia, especially in the beginning, was not at all a very nice state because later, obviously, living standards were rising because of American funding. But especially in the beginning, from 45 to 51, it was a lot of violence petered out against all regime opponents and especially also against the farmers. The most brutal example is the so-called Jasin Farmer Rebellion of the 6th of May of 1950, and that was in Bosnia, and it was a brutal reprisal then done against the farmers. They were Muslim farmers. They didn't like the land collectivization, which also Yugoslavia did at that point. And obviously, that was a brutal atrocity. So Yugoslavia in no way, also in that phase, was a very nice or beautiful democracy. No, no, no. It was a very brutal socialist dictatorship. But by accepting Western money, there came some strings attached. With 51, there was already then a little bit of less socialist adventurism possible. Because when you take money, you also have to behave somehow, otherwise it doesn't continue to flow. And that was also an experience which the Yugoslavia had. Obviously, in the 50s they continued, but in 61 they formed this global association, the Non-Aligned Movement, which to this day is one of the international networks and sources of powers of Serbia. Because it is this kind of third way socialist anti-colonial project of being socialist economically, talking high about ideals and suppressing their own people. And that's what the non-aligned movement is basically about, yeah, in many of the places. But obviously they failed all great while driving with open cars, with the emperor of Ethiopia and the president of Indonesia, and all had the new gained independence from the colonial powers, well deserved, and that was very good. But obviously they didn't choose the free world, but they chose some kind of persiflage, some kind of socialist Yugoslavian third way. And it looked somehow attractive because it worked everything in Yugoslavia at that moment, at least what was seeable, because the Americans paid for it. And, you know, then you can build some nice things for some moment, but long term, such a kind of development system obviously was bent to fail. But still today, on the 1st of September, everybody celebrates the non-aligned movement creation, and Tito is an honorable man, and all these things. And it was a completely failed system. And obviously, but the world was interested to have Yugoslavia not in the Soviet bloc. And so Yugoslavia also reformed. Yeah. So there, under the funding suggestions, I would say, of the Americans, and also in an effort to continue to break away Tito from Stalin and also from his successors, there was then a new constitution on the 7th of April 1963, and it was so that Tito appointed himself for life. That's obviously one thing also Putin has with love, and it's a kind of similarity in some aspects, but that constitution fitted very well in his kind of personal leadership cult, which he liked, and the Americans paid for everything. And that was obviously leading to a lot of, you know, you can buy a lot of compliance and complicity when you have money. Then Tito was allowed to meet the Queen, to meet Kennedy, to meet Khrushchev, to meet Churchill, and so on and so on. And I'm sure he felt wonderful. And also the Yugoslavian people felt quite good, because they felt, of course, respect, recognized, yeah, even when their economic situation was already going down significantly. And the moment of real no return came in the year 65. And that obviously was the moment of the big financial reforms. They called it the so-called hard dinner. Hard dinner means devaluation. It's always in socialism, you call the things by different names, while you somehow confuse everybody. The so-called hard dinner was a devaluation. It's quite funny, actually. That happened on the 24th of July, when they had no money anymore in 65, and they had to really change their economic policy. So what they did is obviously devalue it. That's obviously what all of the socialist and failed states do, and they have to do. But also they made one very specific, they tried to get more debt, you know, the more funding from the US, and the US gave it because it was the Cold War, and the Germans had to pay as well. But also the countries, what they did, and especially in Yugoslavia, it was, of course, always an exporter of people. And so Germany was already so productive with the hard currency. They had a real hard currency, the mark, pegged to the euro. And also Germany was booming by then because of the Western integration, the start of the EU. And obviously they needed more people to work, and then started the success model of exporting people to Germany and to Austria, basically. That was the most important, but also to Belgium and also to Sweden. But most important, the biggest dimension, was the so-called Gastarbeiter treaties, which was concluded directly after this. I think it was on the 12th of October in 1966, yeah? And 66. There were several Gastarbeiter treaties. So it was basically immediately after the 65 devaluation and the economic crisis. Then came the Gastarbeiter treaties. And this is very significant volumes of people, because it's often forgotten. Just to give you the exact numbers, you know, in some ways, they had about 670,000 people working abroad. Huh? You know, it was total number of 20% of the employed people, because it was a specific status in Yugoslavia. You were working, you were registered as employed, but employed abroad. And this was 20% of the working population. I mean, that was kind of significant, I think. Yeah? And obviously it was very prestigious to work abroad, because it was one of the few jobs. If you were not working for the state security, some state companies, working abroad was obviously very prestigious, and it was done in quotas. So the less privileged groups, like the Macedonians or the Albanians or the poorer regions, they were less often given these opportunities, because it was seen as a prestigious way to earn your money. And then absolutely there was also discriminations already in that one. Let me also say, for example, in 71 alone from Bosnia, there were 140,000 people working abroad. In 71, in 81, 173,000. And so on. You can see it in all levels, in all republics. There was a huge outflow. Obviously, less from the richer republics like Slovenia and Serbia, but also from Serbia. There were almost 300,000 people working outside. And it was the start of the prosperity. I know many of the families in Kosovo, the first time they could build a house or have some kind of proper living standards, was when they had people working in Germany or Austria and they were sending money back. So that was really a very decisive factor. It led also to the so-called Gastarbeiterroute. That was the big, it was not a highway at that time, and there were many car accidents. That was the big Alpine crossing from central Germany via Austria to Yugoslavia, also including Turkey later, where this was a massive drive towards the centers where the work and the industry in Europe is based, along the Rhine River, and then going back in the summer and in the winter to be with the family, and going back then to work in the industrial centers of Europe in the summer. So basically that's the economic model of Yugoslavia, and so it continued. And it only got worse absolutely then after the link with the US was broken when Milosevic took power. After his speech in April 87 and his change of narrative or identity or ideological kind of shift. Yeah? Because you have to understand the rise of Milosevic to power, it's a very decisive moment in 87 when he understood this debt-burdened Yugoslavia will not sustain itself. There will be some reforms. They all also saw the situation in Moscow, Gorbachev, and they were thinking and they were calculating what kind of legitimate basis will drive the future together. Stambulic was the heir of Tito in some ways, and he wanted to keep everything together on the ideological basis of Bratstvo Jedinstvo, unity, brotherhood, and, you know, finding some money somewhere, probably in Europe at that stage, yeah? And somehow avoiding the breakup and the whole situation, and which then later happened, and that has to be, he should be honored for that. Milosevic, after his visit in Kosovo and how the Serb element and the population in Kosovo, they have shown him the key to power. And they have basically revolutionized whatever. They have the mix of their toxic nationalism, their effort as a minority. They were about 20%, let's say 15% of the population in Serbia at that stage, about 200,000 Kosovo Serbs. About 2 million all in all living in that province at that stage. And what happened? It was a toxic mix. There was this nationalist element of the Kosovo Serbs ready to fight for somebody which takes on their agenda in Yugoslavia. And there was some younger political apparatchnik, Milosevic, who wanted to rise to power. They found each other. And so it happened, and he took then full power in the next 2 years, and he then, on this kind of new ideological basis, shifting away from Yugoslavianism towards communist nationalism, or socialist nationalism, yeah? A kind of ultimately genocidal mix between socialist economics with all its negative aspects together with Serb nationalistic and historicistic narrative of a Serb land united, yeah, without anybody else. And this kind of terrible mix started because it was already there, but, you know, they had to find the instruments of power. This was Milosevic, but the narrative was already there. And obviously the mix of debt and no kind of clear future together, because all the other people of Yugoslavia, they saw already the signs at the door. You know, they were obviously knowing the debt level, and they saw no kind of future united in that level. And so it happened. Yeah. Good. It was on the 27th of April or the 24th. I will check that. 87. Yeah. And then let me just think about the so-called, yeah, moment, one moment, yeah. This is important also to understand when it comes to the so-called agro-commerce affair. This is what I wanted to talk. And also about the, yeah, it's the agro-commerce affair. You know, everything was getting then in the high inflation area and also in this kind of economic mechanizations, when you see that you want to reform, but you don't know how. And then it was very exciting times. And this is what I wanted to talk about. Excuse me. Yeah, that was the currency reforms were coming. At one time, it was basically the dinar was like the Austrian shilling that they wanted to pack it similar like the mark. Yeah? That was in 1990. But it all didn't work out anymore. The whole situation of debt, inflation, monetary stability, everyone side wanted to reform, and this was called Mr. Markovic, and the other side wanted to take the power completely. And then came the decisive moment, which has to be understood, it's so important, because the real breakup of Yugoslavia, the moment of no return, was not the speeches in Kosovo. They were all very important, no doubt, in this inner Communist Party struggle. But it was when the $1.5 billion loan was done directly from the national, from the federal central bank to the Serbian state. So what basically, this is important to understand, in such a kind of a multi-republic federation, you have to be fair to each other. Otherwise, the one side pays into the national coffers and the other side takes. And that is exactly what it happened. Yeah, and this was a real major scandal. The Croatian prime minister, he was the prime minister of Yugoslavia, Ante Markovic, tried to somehow reform everything. But they took out, he also applied, was in Washington in 89, and he asked for debt relief. And, you know, that would have all been possible. Yeah? But there was no goodwill anymore from Serbia. And they took this unilateral $1.5 billion loan from the central bank to fund the Serbian state security apparatus. Basically, they stole from all the others. And that was obviously a major issue. And then when it was already so clear, and then they did this major decapitation, whatever, this kind of attack when Markovic, he was in Croatia at that moment, and then the own air force, they flew a strike into Zagreb on the 7th of October 91, basically to cover up this theft, yeah, and to kill the people in the know, like Markovic and also the Croatian leadership, yeah. That was basically a cover-up effort of this bank robbery of the decade. It was a bank robbery, ultimately. And so it all exploded. And it was very much about money and debt. It later was about, you know, personal ambitions, and then later about land borders and all these things. But very much in the core of the Yugoslavian disaster is this economic failure, the massive debt problem they had, the lack of any kind of growth perspective, and then devaluation, constant devaluation of the currency from 65 onwards in a constant decline, ending in the hyperinflation of the early 90s, and then basically in fratricide and civil war. I mean, this is the short version. And today, so many people talk about Yugo-nostalgia, how great it was, how successful it was, and how much better than today. This is unfortunately, even in Western commentators, they repeat such a kind of toxic narrative, which also in Austria, some people say, yeah, and Hitler built, I mentioned the name, you know, and Lord Voldemort even built the highways, yeah. You know, it's exactly like that, yeah. And that people say, yeah, something was good in the past. Oh, but in reality, nothing was good in Yugoslavia. Of course, you know, it was maybe, you know, compared to the genocide, which then happened at the beginning, yeah. But compared to Italy, or compared to Greece, compared to Austria, compared to Germany, it's not a natural law that Southeastern Europe must be poor. And it's actually today already very developed. Don't get me wrong. Now you see, under normal European security and regulatory situation, monetary situation, Southeastern Europe can be just as rich as all other European parts and regions and countries. But it's this kind of a system which was bent to decline, and it was really a major problem from the start. Yeah? And it has only survived so long because of massive American debt access and funding due to the Cold War. And once the Cold War was basically no longer so controversial with Gorbachev, the case for funding so Yugoslavian illusions so massively was getting less dominant in Washington. And so basically the internal fights for the scarce resources broke out, and then Milosevic, he pulled the trigger with in Kosovo with this changing of his own political platform towards Serbian nationalism, and also then fighting for resources, stealing from the other federations and from the other states, from the other republics, and so basically bankrupting Yugoslavia as a federation for benefiting of Serbia. And then what happened also very clearly by these wars which he started, then came the embargo and the massive devaluations again and again. And yes, he took then these two interventions to stop his genocidal wars in Bosnia and Kosovo. And there we are today, in this mess we are. Now, of course, everything is much better, there is no doubt. I don't want to sound too negatively. We are now in 2021. But what I cannot accept, and what I think is very worrying, when there is somehow this kind of repeating by international journalists or observers, somehow that Yugoslavia was a role model, Yugoslavia was not so bad, Yugoslavia was killing its own citizens abroad, Yugoslavia had a massive campaign of external killings, Yugoslavia was a political authoritarian dictatorship, there was no political freedom in Yugoslavia, economically it was an absolute disaster, the inheritance is an industrial wasteland in many of the places which the EU will have to clean up, as we have done already in Slovenia and Croatia, and we have to clean up all the new members, because communism left such a terrible legacy of reckless industrialization beyond any kind of caring for the environment. So there will be billions and billions needed to clean up the whole legacy of Tito's Yugoslavia, still in Serbia, Bosnia, Kosovo. And I've seen many of the factories myself. They are a complete disaster, and it will be billions, multi-billions needed to clean up all the things which Yugoslavia has committed against the environment. And so I don't know what was exactly good, you know, in Yugoslavia. If somebody can explain me, obviously with the Western funding, there was some access to apartments, and, you know, there was also some form of understanding in this phase between 65, basically the economic first economic collapse, and then until Milosevic took power in 87 and started his genocidal activities. So we can say in these 20 years, under the Western pressure and guidance, Tito has tried to keep some kind of stability, and the worst excesses of his dictatorship could be mitigated by the Western ambassadors, in order he was obviously needing the money. And so he avoided all this kind of policies, which up to then in Kosovo very clearly was absolute dictatorship under Janković. Janković was only removed because this kind of extremism could not be tolerated as long as the money should be flowing from Washington. So basically there was some better phase relatively to the disaster before and disaster afterwards between 65 and 87. But also me personally, just if I want to close and tell my personal experience as a child going to Yugoslavia in 78, the first time with my grandmother, and also seeing the sea the first time coming from Austria, and the toilets were all just holes in the floor. And the situation was really underdeveloped, as I have not witnessed it before. And the streets and the roads, I know now all of Yugoslavia, ex-Yugoslavia, very well from driving. It was completely underdeveloped in terms of infrastructure and in terms of industry. I know also many of the factories, especially in the south of, but in Montenegro I know them, in Kosovo, in Macedonia, and also some in Serbia and in Bosnia, and they are in a disastrous condition. You know, when somebody talks about Yugos nostalgia and how good it was once, I don't know on which kind of factual evidence that should be based. And I can neither from my personal experience nor from my business and consulting experience, I can not understand that anybody thinks that Yugoslavia was a good state. Obviously, you know, for the ones who were regime conform, there was maybe an apartment and a job in a company without productivity. There was some movement of freedom and some minimal property rights. Yes, but for the rest, it was the open door policy. The difference to communism was already that they could go to Vienna or to Germany when they were not happy. But if you were then politically active as a Croatian, for example, in Germany, you could be easily killed as well in Germany or in Australia or anywhere. So this is the situation of former Yugoslavia. So when somebody tells me, the Yugo nostalgia, it was so good, I really wonder in which Yugoslavia this person has been. Yeah? Obviously, you know, for the few connected to the regime, yeah, like you are a military policeman or you are a kind of a state civil servant or you are the manager of a big company, maybe then for you and your family it was okay-ish, yeah, in a sense. Or you have later then privatized it with some corruptive deal and you have basically benefited very much. Or you were already, no, that's probably the only criteria, and you were somehow surviving all the purges and staying on the good side of politics all the time, then maybe it was a decent kind of situation. But never there was freedom, never there was democracy, never there was security, and it all went down in a big bang, in a terrible collapse of the financial and political system during 91 to 99 and 2000, basically. And now we have 20 years of normality, but unfortunately in Serbia they were not so normal in many ways because of the killing of Cinjic and also because of the backslash in democracy. Again, this narrative of disaster has unfortunately prevailed, yeah? And this needs to change in order to be ready for the European Union. Such a Yugo nostalgia cannot take place in the European Union. And we have to make very clear that Yugoslavia was a disaster to prepare all the countries for NATO, EU and Euro membership. because all of the successor states of Yugoslavia should be in Europe, fully integrated in NATO, EU, and in the Euro, and as fast as possible. But the first thing which needs to be done is not to adopt the consumer regulation or the physiosanitary kind of standards. That's also very important. But the first thing is to be clear that Yugoslavia was a disaster. And this has to be very, very clear. And this has to be also openly discussed and understood. And any kind of Yugo nostalgia or whatever kind of communist nostalgia is as bad as anybody promoting fascism. Yeah, this is an absolutely disaster system, and it was nothing good. You know, this is the basis of European democracy. And as I tweet regularly, who thinks that Yugoslavia was a good state cannot join the European Union. And so we have to destroy the myth of Yugo nostalgia and also the economic illusions of this kind of myth, and to get ready for the European Union. Good, more to come against Yugo nostalgia. Thanks a lot for listening. Bye.